Les colloques du Collège de France.
Our next speaker is Professor Gege Shibra for Central European University.
Thank you very much. I'm going to continue from where Barbu left off, a little bit broadening the picture, but you will see lots of repetitions here. So, consider the following displays. Let's start with the one that already you heard about. This is the representation of the offside rule in European football. I borrowed it from Barbu. Here is another one, a video game where these entities are running around and eating the dot and chasing each other. The demonstration of how to cut up a chicken by a master chef. A scoreboard with tallies. A puppet theater scene. A representation of a family tree in a diagram, pretending that a banana is a telephone. Assembly instructions for your IKEA furniture. Showing your bathroom arrangement to others in a restaurant with the cutleries, and a famous animation from Heider and Zimmer from the 1940s. Let me add three more displays, which are actual stimuli used in infant studies. This is the first one. Barbu already talked about this. So here, infants are shown the leftward animation many times, and the question, what is their intuition, what should happen when you remove this black rectangle from the middle? Apparently they think that this should happen here. Or another study in which this red circle is seen struggling, trying to go up to the top of the hill, and then another agent is coming and pushing it down or pushing it upwards. The third one is a study with real objects. These are the sequence of events that's happening there. There is a box and then four little dolls put on the bottom of the box, and then they pairwise turn into each other and say hello, hello. And then they are put back into the box. Some of them are retrieved, and then infants can search in the box. And this is how they measure how many objects they still think in the box. Apparently, they remember better the number of dolls went to the box when they were pairwise greeting each other compared to when they individually greet the infant itself. So what I'm going to suggest that these displays are very different from each other. Some of them are static, some of them are dynamic, some of them are real objects, others with visual objects, some of them include humans, others don't include humans, some of them include labels, and so on. So it's lots of differences here, but I suggest that at the deep level there are some commonalities among them which is very important for us. And just obviously call these things are symbolic depictions. So what's the commonality? All of these objects are made of discrete elements, real or visual objects, which are arranged in space and time to express or represent something. So these are external representations. Now, what they are expressing something about is not the objects in the scene. So there was a debate about this, but it's potential interpretation here that these are what they're expressing something about is not the bottles, but something about the rules of the game, usually played by footballers. But this is not a banana, but a telephone. This object is a knife here, but it's expressing something about how to use a knife, cutting up a chicken, and not how to how this actual object used on that particular chicken, and so on. So in that sense, just repeating what Barbara says, these object displays, the objects in these displays stand for something other than themselves, and this sense, and this is how we use this word here, they are symbols. Now, what they are standing for, I will call them discourse referents, because the referent here plays the same kind of function that discourse referents play in linguistic utterances. And so symbols don't stand here for concepts, but for discrete singular entities. What's important here to emphasize here is that this, the fact that I'm saying that these objects work as symbols and the discourse reference as discourse reference, it doesn't mean that they are in any way labeled in your mind definitely as symbols or discourse reference. These are architectural roles that they play in the scenes. The fact that that you set up a stand for relations between two different representations, that's what make one of them is a symbol and the other is the discourse reference. They don't have to have any other separate labels. Now, how do you know what these symbols stand for? There are various kinds of information. This could be exemplifications, like this. I just put this here in order to show that, of course, what you learn from this display, the offside rule, is a rule. So what we are showing them is an exemplar of how this rule works, right? And what people get out of this display is not about this particular situation, what happens in this particular spatial arrangement, but what the general rule is. But you can also figure out what something stands for on the basis of resemblance, just like iconic resemblance. You can use labels. One can use conventions. Those conventionally stand for human beings. And you can use just behavioral roles, whatever role the object plays in the situation, this stands for a telephone because that's the role it plays in the situation. And this is also true for the Heiderenzimmel animations. However, let me emphasize that this kind assignments are absolutely not necessary in these situations. If they are there, they help the interpretation and especially help you to extend whatever you learn to novel situations. But if you just interpret the situational role that the symbol plays in the display, that's sufficient for the minimal comprehension of the depiction. So if you think about these tallies, if you see this, they understand that this is a symbolic display. They understand that each of the strokes stand for a particular entity. It could be an object, it could be an event, it could be any kind of discrete entity. And the only thing you know about them is their sequential position in the counting routine, right? So in that sense, in Gabor's term, these symbols don't necessarily carry any cargo. Many of times they carry some cargo, but even if they don't carry any cargo, they are not completely empty because their roles in the situations defines what they do. And that also applies to the offside rule as well, because if you say that these are not footballers, just bottles that arranged in a way to be interpreted as play footballs, then they are footballers, not in the sense that they are humankind in sort of a taxonomic sense, but in the sense that they play the role in the situation as footballers. So, and this leads us to the second important element of these symbolic displays, that they, with the help of these objects, they represent relations, states of affairs, or events involving the discourse reference by arranging the symbols in space and time appropriately. So, these relations state of affairs and events are not expressed by symbols, but are depicted by the spatial and temporal relations among the objects in an iconic format. So obviously space and time can easily and analogously represent spatial and temporal relations, but this is used in many different ways. In using these symbolic depictions, you can represent by social interaction. Think about the Heider and Zimmer animations, kinship, possession, causality rules, all kinds of relations you can. Of course, it's a very heavily inferential process to interpret them this way, but still they can be interpreted this way, and we do this many times. So the first claim I'm making here, that arranging objects in space and time to express relations or events constitutes a medium for an external representational system in this semi-symbolic format. It's a semi-symbolic format because it includes both symbols and also iconic elements. This medium gives rise to an open-ended compositional and heavily inferential representational system with a clear predicate argument structure. Here the predicates are depicted iconically over the discrete symbols as their arguments. This is why I call them symbolic depictions. And of course, the expressive power of these symbolic depictions is much lower than that of natural language, not just because it doesn't have symbols for predicates, but it doesn't include all kinds of elements that language can use to express various kinds of things, quantifiers, tense aspects, or all kinds of things that are missing here. However, difference from language is that, in principle, some of these symbolic depictions can work without convention. Think about again the Heider and Zimmer animation, which is understood by, or at least interpreted by everyone. And it was interpreted even in the 1940s, where that was the first time that people saw these kind of animations with geometric figures. Now, you may object that it's a bit arbitrary to carve up the world the way that I'm doing, that putting together action demonstrations of how to cut up a chicken with Heider and Zimmer and the banana and all kinds of things. So this would include one kind of things, and we exclude other kinds of graphical representations or paintings or kinds of other things. And that you may be right, but I would still argue that this is really a separate kind of representational system, and it is because I would argue that it has a psychological reality. And the psychological reality is that there is an internal representation format in our brains which is analogous with these external symbolic depictions. The best example of this representational system is used in, it's called sometimes scene constructions or episodic simulations or similar things, in which you imagine discrete elements, put them in spatial and temporal relations, and this is usually represented in the hippocampal formation, as mentioned and explained by Ellen A.S. today, which, as she told us, it could index actual individuals, not necessarily exist individuals, just perception, but by generally just imagining individuals. But also, the hippocampal structure could actually represent them in specific spatial relations. One could also call this working memory. Sometimes actually the same thing is referred as a working memory, and that's a functional description, so I don't have any problem with them, but I don't use the term, because working memory could actually extend it to other kinds of formats, other kinds of representations that more describe what you're doing with them and not necessarily what the format is. But it actually, it's a working memory in the sense that these simulations are usually temporary. So episodic in the sense that that they are not permanently stored. Right. So, as I as just like with the external depictions, these constructions can represent not only spatial and temporal relations, but other kinds of relations as well. And it was also shown that they exist very similar way in other human animals. These are mainly neuroscience studies that show them that the other species also create these kind of scenes in the hippocampal region. And it's also true that they also use it not just for representing spatial relations. So if you teach rodents very complex relations between which various kinds of events that they learn, that they tend to put them into a spatial structure in order to represent the relations between the various kinds of stimuli. So then, then one can ask this question whether this is a language of thought, right? So recently it has been argued that language of thought could take many different formats, and this could be one of them. So in a paper recently, Quilty Dunn and colleagues argued that there are six criteria to judge whether something is a language of thought. So if we look at them, then it's not quite clear whether there is a yes or no answer to this question. So this internal representation system exhibit role filler independence. It has a clear predicate argument structure. It can represent abstract content. At the same time, it applies no logical operators. It includes discrete constituents, but it's not completely made of discrete constituents, so the spatial relations among them is actually a necessary component. And the co-inferential promiscuity, the idea that from representation all possible inferences are automatically drawn there, and I'm pretty sure that that's not the case from the kind of representations that I'm talking about it, but at the same time, these could be inferentially productive representations. This is why we are using them. They can be inferentially productive. We can use the spatial structure for various kinds of operations and manipulations on the scene, separating and combining sets, ordering, comparing, and so on. You can also import domain-specific knowledge about entities if you know what these things are. A very simple way, if you represent two objects on top of each other, you may import your knowledge about the world that there is gravity, so that there's not just a spatial relation between the two objects, but there are mechanical relations, that they exert force on each other and so on. So you can import domain-specific knowledge if you have something like that. Now, the other relation to language here is that just like humans have both internal and external languages, humans can also externalize these internal representations into a real world by creating those symbolic depictions that I started the talk with. So then, what mental processes engage this format? First of all, the kind of things that I mentioned that heavily studied in cognitive neuroscience, like planning, imagination, memory. When you create these internal representations from elements, they could be existing individuals that you know. You can imagine your friends chatting to each other in this situation, or you can just create new tokens of familiar kinds, or you can create all kinds of things to put them together in this situation. Second, perception can also be represented in this semi-symbolic form. This is not a perceptual representational form, but your perceptual experiences could be converted into this semi-symbolic form as soon as your system somehow decides which objects in your scene is worthy of representing as a symbol and put them into relation with others. Then that's what you can do. And most importantly, you can create these internal representations by translating external symbolic depictions, the kind of things that I showed you, and translating into these internal representations, which practically generally share the same format. So this is also done by perception, but it's guided by your interpretation of the scene. That those things, what objects on the scene should be treated as symbols, as standing for something. And of course, then it's a further inferential process to figure out what they stand for. So in order to make this translation, there are two requirements. First, you have to recognize a symbolic depiction as a symbolic depiction. And second, you have to align somehow the two kinds of representations. Recognizing some of the symbolic depictions is probably almost trivial because if you just look at my screen, I expect that you find there some symbolic depictions. You can also, you are familiar with all kinds of devices, from screens to books to posters, puppet theaters, that you know that they are used for symbolic depictions. But even if these depictions appear outside this conventional system, you could recognize them usually by communicative cues. So if someone is saying, "I'm going to show you how to carve up a chicken," then whatever is happening in front of you, it's a potential symbolic depiction, and it's usually interpreted like that. So that's relatively easy. The second one is how you align external and internal depictions. This is again where the Stanford relations come back. So it's a very, very simple depiction of how I imagine this process here. So in this particular case, there is an external depiction on which these objects are represented by object files. And represented the track by objects files, and each of the object files that are there is linked to an internal symbolic depictions by this Stanford relation. So there are one-to-one relations both here and between the objects files and the discourse files. So in production, you create your internal symbolic depictions, and then you create for them or find for them external objects that would represent the individual entities, and then arrange them accordingly. And in comprehension, you do the opposite. As soon as you assume that something is a symbolic depiction, then you have the object files for the objects that act as symbols, and for each of them actually generate an internal symbol in this case which would work as a discourse file. So, but note here that setting up these Stanford links there doesn't require referential links from discourse files to the world, right? There could be, but this is not required. So then, how do you track the discourse reference here? You track them by looking at how the objects display are changing, and then you change the internal depictions accordingly. Now, as long as the one-to-one relations between the objects files and the discourse files are maintained, there no ambiguity of identity emerges. So the problem that that you have in linguistic communication with the anaphoric ambiguity, it just doesn't occur. As long as you can track the object files, and then you can maintain these one-to-one relations between the object files and the discourse files. Yes, because in comprehension, the object files and discourse files are addressed differently. The object files are established by perception and tracked by location, while the discourse files are tracked by these Stanford links. So they are just indirectly related to the world. How am I in time? 20 more minutes?
20.
Oh, good. So the third claim I want to make here, coming back to Barbu's talk, is that this format of internal symbolic depictions is available in early human ontogeny, and that it is preferentially recruited when infants are confronted with symbolic depictions, right? So that's how you could trigger to set up these internal symbolic depictions. I'm not claiming that that's the only case when they do that, but that's the point that I'm trying to make here. So in order to do that, as I mentioned, they have to be able to recognize that they are confronted with the external symbolic depictions, which again, they can do this by recognizing practically communication, communicative interactions, which includes objects, or always raise the possibility that these the objects used in the communication are actually playing the role of symbols, and the relations among them should be interpreted that way. But of course, infants, depending on their cultural environment, they can learn relatively quickly. Definitely by 1.5 years of age, that was Barbu's first study, to understand that there are media around them which they can just recognize that are used for depictions. And so in this case, they don't even need additional direct human communicative signals in order to get the idea that what they see is, are potentially symbolic depictions. And the other crucial point here, which you already mentioned, if it is true that some of these symbolic depictions can be interpreted without conventions, then infants are in a good position to start to interpret them. But that's a question whether this is what they do. So a whole literature in early human cognition, that's what we do. That's what I've been doing in the last 30-something years. I'm showing infants to symbolic depictions, and I'm interested whether they interpret them, or whether they can understand them or not. And the whole literature is usually presented as I showed infants agents moving around, and they understood what's going on. But of course, you don't show them agents moving around. You show them symbols of agents moving around. This is how you created them. So the question is whether infants just perceive these events that showed them as real events unfolding in front of their eyes, or they interpret them as symbolic depictions, and this is how they interpret them. So, I'm going to to be honest, there is no clear yes or no answer to this question. So, there is no single study that would show that infants interpret these kind of displays as symbolic displays. But there are some aspects of these studies that would suggest that it's more easily interpreted if that's the case. Let me just show you some examples. So here is this, again, the same kind of event that I showed you before. An object is jumping and then arriving to another, next to another object. So you see that symbolic depictions, you can create symbolic depictions in your mind about that, right? Have you done that? Okay, now look at your symbolic depictions from above, right? What do you see? Do you see the first one or the second options here? Do you understand my question here?
First.
Okay. So I guess you see the first one. Most people would say that, but note that the original display was completely ambiguous with respect to that. It could be either the first or the second one, and you see the first one because you interpreted what is being shown to you by that display, and that gives you an inference about the depth relations among these elements. Now, I guess the fact that infants interpret these events very similarly to you, this is what the studies are showing, would suggest that again they go through the first interpreting these depictions, what is being shown to you, and this is how they, on the basis of that, they construct the scene behind it. But think about this. Other study I already showed you this. This red object is struggling to go up to this hill against gravity, and you understand that's what he's trying to do. But look at the other two objects, what they do there. They're just hanging in the air, just levitating in the air, as if gravity would not have an effect on them, right? So in that sense, if you interpreted this as perceiving these events as real, happening in real time in front of you, that would be a kind of contradiction, right? You have to bring in various kinds of additional assumptions about the capabilities of those two objects there, that they are just hanging in the air. But if this is just a representation of events and relations between these objects, then you understand that whenever they are just up there, they are not part of the scene, they are just observers somewhere, and they're just put there in the scene. So again, if you interpret them this way, and this is how most of us interpret it this way, then this contradiction doesn't even appear. And if it doesn't appear in infants, that suggests that you also interpreted them as depictions. Or think about these events. So this is a study in which objects are moved around in real objects in front of the infants in the scene. And then later they are occluded with occluders, and then disoccluded, and to test to figure out how much infants remember what was where behind the occluders. But it turns out that these are two objects. Then they don't actually remember which object was behind which occluder. But if one of them is this doll head, the other is a object, then they do, right? So this is interpreted by the authors, I think it's rightly, that they do this because they represent humans and non-humans in a different way, different kinds of objects in a very high level, and therefore that allows them to track what is where. But if infants think that object is a human, then they have a really, really strange idea of what a human is, that could be grabbed by hands and move them around in that stage. Alternatively, if they think that these are just symbols of these entities, so maybe that's a symbol of an object that allows them to represent them as a symbol of a human, and therefore it would allow them to make the same kind of inferences about occlusion without actually representing them as real objects. And that's the same argument that can be said about these objects. These objects should be interpreted both as interacting entities, otherwise you would not get the same result if they are not interacting entities. But at the same time, infants have no problem understanding that these objects are put into these boxes. They are not afraid of reaching into the boxes and trying to find them and so on. Those kind of things that you don't usually do with infants. Now, when I'm presenting this, the most likely question that I receive from others is that isn't this in contradiction with the most famous studies about symbolic understanding in young children, which Barbozo mentioned, Judy Deloach studies that showed that children below 3 years of age really struggle to understand objects as potential symbols. So I didn't know that Barb would show this, so I'm going to show you a little video about these studies, just because it's actually simpler to understand what's going on than when I explain it.
This model is an exact representation of a room next door, only on a much smaller scale. This 2.5-year-old watches as a miniature toy is hidden somewhere in the scale model.
Little Snoopy's gonna hide right here.
Then we tell them we're gonna hide the larger toy in the same place in the room itself. So we do that without the child watching. We come back and we say, okay, can you go find the big toy in the room?
Go find him.
Okay, good idea.
The only way that the child has any idea where to search for the larger toy in the room is if they understand something about the symbolic relation between the model and the room.
Is he there?
Nope, he's not under him.
Okay.
If you don't understand that relation, then it's extremely difficult. And in fact, the only way to find the toy in the room is just by guessing.
Behind here? Nope.
It's very challenging. Most 2.5-year-olds fail this task.
Little Snoopy is gonna hide right behind there.
3-year-olds, though, typically have no problem playing this game.
You got him!
We get information from pictures, from maps, from numbers, from reading text via different kinds of symbolic representations. So there's really nothing, I would argue, more important for the development of children than to learn about these kinds of symbolic representations.
Okay. So sorry about that. Many of you knew this before, but I expected that some of them would not. That's the simplest way to present it. So what is task about it? Let me try to reconstruct Judy Deloach's internal symbolic depictions of the scene by my external symbolic depictions. So there is a toy dog and a larger toy dog. And the idea is that the little one stands for the large one. There are also furniture items, which also in the small, in the model, and in the rear room, and they are expected to be understood to stand for each other. And also, what we also have to understand that the arrangement of the symbols in the model room represent the actual situation, the current actual situation in the room. So, and this is how Deloach understood it, so that they have the symbols, they have the stand for relations, and then if children can understand these relations in this way, then they would succeed. And so, because they don't succeed, they argued that she has a problem with understanding symbols or the stand for relations. So compare this to the symbolic depictions that I was talking about that an infant. So in this case, there are these objects and in this particular experiments, for example, and they are expected that the infants understand that they stand for certain objects or agents and understand the behavior among them. For example, in this case, they are interacting with each other. And that they understand that the arrangements and the temporal arrangements represents an episode in the scene. So as you can see, these are very similar schemes in the two cases. In both of them, you have symbols, you have stand for relations. The difference is that in the depiction case, you have discourse reference and not real reference. You have an episode, which is an imaginary episode, while in the reality you have a real situation. And therefore, you can say that the arrangements of the objects in the scale model represents the situation, right? It's represented in the strong sense because it's subject to a truth condition, right? It represents only if the arrangement corresponds to the arrangements in the room. So in that sense, this is a representation that could potentially misrepresent. That's not the case in the case of depictions. These symbols can actually depict an episode and can understand what's going on there, but they cannot depict it because there is no factor of the matter that would actually decide whether something is true or not, right? So whatever is represented, whatever is being depicted, is being depicted, but you cannot misdepict it. So the simple explanation for this potential contradiction that I argue that even infants understand symbolic relations, while these studies show that even three-year-olds are hardly processing them, is that it's possible that children represent the scale model in this way. So in understand that that items in the scale model represent a room, right? They represent a dog, a sofa, a table, and so on. So understand it, and so therefore they form the Stanford relations. But of course, because these discourse reference have no corresponding entities in the world, they would not be able to apply it to the real room and find it. So then the next question is then how three-year-olds solve this task. I guess they solve this task by understanding that this reference that they know from, because before they see the model, they actually see, they are shown the room, so they are familiar with the room. They understand that the elements of this room actually the ones that they should use as discourse reference here. So therefore, I guess when they set up this episode representation that they just borrow, they just practically copy from this reference to this internal symbolic depiction. And if they also understand that it's not just the items corresponds to each other, but the actual situation correspond to each other, then they would actually understand that this model represents the situation. So, 3 years, children solve the task by linking mental representations of the items to the rooms to the discourse reference, and assuming correspondence between the depicted episode and the actual situation of the room. Now, it's important to realize here that the links here between the room and the model are not generated spontaneously. It's actually induced by linguistic expressions from the experiment. They are the ones who tell them that, look, these are the same kind of things. All right. So then what follows from is that, at least in the context of symbolic depictions, children initially establish Stanford links from external symbols to discourse reference without existential commitment. This suggests that, at least developmentally and conceptually, discourse files are not modified versions of regular files. At least they are not created by modifying regular files, despite the fact that how they set up depends on the presence of perceptual objects, that is the symbols. And that linking non-referring discourse files to real entities may normally require linguistic intervention. Not always, there are exceptions. I can generate exceptions, but those are really exceptions. All right, so this is the summary of what I tried to convince you today, as that spatial representational system of the brain is exploited for representing events and relations in semi-symbolic, semi-iconic format. and that humans externalize this format by using objects as symbols in real space and time, and that aligning internal and external symbolic depictions requires humans to set up stand-for links between object files and discourse files, that infants are capable of doing so. They can translate external symbolic depictions into internal ones, and these internal depictions are initially made of non-referring discourse files. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please raise your hand for questions. Gabor.
Thank you. I have a question about your sort of reinterpretation of the Deloge study, and I still feel like there is some tension with children's or like with infant success and children's failure there, because even under your discourse preference still, I mean, probably can be understood appropriately and inappropriately. And in the video that you showed, like knowing that in a bucket would be perfectly sufficient to find it in the other room, if that's how you set up your discourse reference, you should search in something that's a bucket. And similarly, in a left pillow of a couch, that also could work as well. Even if I don't understand the direct connection that, oh, this is an exact replica. So I feel like if I want to both explain the fact that children sort of maintain these, make the appropriate inferences based on the stimuli that are presented, but somehow they don't make the appropriate inferences here, I feel like there is still some link that's missing.
I mean, there are two issues here. One of them is that they can represent the what a mother showed them in linguistic way, right? And it's actually possible that when the 3-year-olds can solve the task, this is what they do. They just linguistically decode that the object is under the sofa, and then they go and find it under the sofa. That's a possibility. I'm not sure whether anyone ever investigated this. But the second question is that you wonder what children are searching for, right? If at all, right? And I guess that they really don't understand the situation in this case. They understand that they would have to search for a toy in the room, but they have no idea how this toy related to whatever they were shown before.
So you would predict that if the experimenter would fake them and bring out a completely different toy and would say, oh, it was here, they would be happy with that at the end of their search task?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a follow-up.
I mean, they probably know what kind of toy they are looking for. It's not that they're completely they don't know what kind of, but they don't know what's the relation between that toy and the toy in the model.
Right. Yeah, I had more or less a very similar question. there was one discussion about Judy Deloach's experiments that she always used only one kind of object in the room, right? Only one couch and so on. And that's therefore you wouldn't have to really understand the similarity of the layout. And so if and they knew that, they were told that both dogs have a ball or something, right? So they were looking for Big Snoopy's ball. And you basically said, they said that Big Snoopy has, in his room, has put the ball under this here and pointing to the chair or whatever bench in the little room. So that struck me as being more or less the same as a verbal instruction.
Yeah.
The ball is under an object like this.
Right, yeah.
In the big room, so you go in and look where there is a bench and then you find it.
Yeah, that's the pointing version, definitely. That's exactly my interpretation is as well. When you point to something, then practically the demonstrative this is just replaced by the by the labeled object, yep. And then this is what conveys that. But the original version, there was no pointing. There was actually hiding a replica object behind it. So there's no pointing there, right? So I mean.
But there is no.
I accept what they say about this. So,
But there is no symbolic relationship between this thing in the small room and this in the big room. It's just they are both of the same kind. And I get the message. It's under this kind of thing.
Right. So, but still, they don't solve it until 3 years of age. So, I mean, I'm not sure what your point is. It's possible that even 3 years of age, they don't have any idea about that. That there is actually a representational relation between the models and the thing. But they just do this kind of linguistic description, and then they look for it. That's a possibility. I don't know that, but I just assume that however they interpreted this, that's correct. But it doesn't have to be correct, you are right.
May I ask a second question, a quick one? Could you show me the slide with tracking symbolic depictions? What are the DRs here? Because I still don't understand what the DRs are. Those
the DOF?
Hmm? The discourse reference.
The discourse reference is whatever those internal symbols there stand for.
So those people
yes,
in there?
Yes, exactly. I mean,
okay.
That's...
So they are imagined entities?
They are imagined entities, but you can imagine entities that exist. So that doesn't exclude the fact that it has to be imaginary entities, but they are imagined entities, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Kyle?
Hello. I wanted to ask about the chicken being cut, just to get a better sense for how you're thinking of the standing for. So if somebody just watched somebody else cutting up a chicken and then generalized from that case, I'm assuming that's not a depiction in the relevant sense. So
yes.
I'm wondering, what is the line between just generalizing from a particular instance that somebody has sort of explicitly signaled they're going to present to you and symbolic depiction? Is there any line there, or
right? Yeah. So when someone is demonstrating to you, so but you're not just observing someone, and you see that someone is doing that this is how it is meant to be interpreted, and this is how you interpret it. That he's showing you how to cut up a chicken with a knife, and even his hand is just a hand. How to hold in a hand, the thing. So that's what's represented. In that sense, it's a symbolic depiction. When you observe someone doing this, you can make similar kinds of inferences that perhaps I can generalize it. But you're not shown that. You don't even think that this display is actually is meant to represent anything. But you can, of course, if this is the purpose of your observation, to figure out, right? This is your quest, the quest that you are after, right? How to learn how to cut up a chicken? Then, of course, you can observe that, and then you can interpret them as that way. But that's not forcing you at all.
I don't know how much time we have.
Two more questions.
Yeah. Go.
Yeah. Quick.
So you're thinking it's sufficient, basically, in any of these cases for it to be symbolic depiction that the person doing the action is wanting their audience to sort of learn a lesson from that.
Yes.
I don't have an objection. I'm absolutely serious about it.
Yes.
So, I mean, there could be a meatier notion of representation where this is not sufficient because they're getting the same information that they would have gotten just generalizing from a case, regardless of whether somebody was doing it.
But you say that it's not necessary, that interpretation, because you can learn from just the exemplar as an exemplar right. observed, right? Absolutely. It's not necessary for learning. But if that's what you are shown, that's an interpreted, that gives you actually a quicker route for learning because it gives you, this license you to extend it to any appropriate knives and any appropriate kitchen, chicken.
But you don't think that you're similarly licensed just watching somebody without having been signaled to that they're doing this for your benefit?
Not similarly. It could be a idiosyncratic way that someone is doing it the first time, and who knows whether that's the right way. It's completely different. Demonstration implies that this is how it is to be done, and by observation it could be, but it doesn't license you that to make that inference.
Thanks.
Valeria.
Hi, thank you very much. And I'm very sympathetic with your view, but I would like to know how much the features of the different formats affect the Stanford relation. So imagine that I have to build some piece of furniture, and there are four different cases. In one case, I'm looking at someone that is gesturing how to do it, and there's nothing there. And then there's someone else who's gesturing at the actual piece of furniture that he has. It's the same as mine, and he's showing it. And then I have some instructions. And then, yes, I'm also, there's someone who took the time to make a model of the piece of furniture and is showing me how to build it on the model. So would you say that in these four cases, the discourse referent is the same?
Yes.
Hans?
I mean, this is how you created these situations, right? You had a discourse reference in mind, and you imagined how different ways I could actually represent them in an action. So,
even in the gesture case.
Yes, of course. That includes further assumptions about the even imagined object in this case, which of course raises questions about how you track them track those objects. But it's not completely impossible. There are studies on that we can actually track imaginary objects in certain circumstances. So, yes.
Hans.
So, you said that the system of symbolic depictions has a smaller expressive power than you find in language. And you said in particular the difference has to do with the fact that you don't have any logical operators in this system, and you do in natural language. And I was wondering what you would be saying about the relation between these two systems, the depictive system and language, in, for instance, the following situation. You show a picture of a number of people standing, and then underneath the picture appears a caption: nobody is sitting, or perhaps everyone is standing. And then the question is, what happens when the observer connects the caption with the picture as a caption of describing the picture? And the two questions that have come to me in this connection. One is it right to think that when the observer just sees the picture, what he forms is a symbolic depiction in his head. And if that is right, what happens when then the caption appears and the observer connects that with this symbolic depiction, or anyway, what he has seen, and in this case actually concludes that the caption is correct?
Oh, in this case, the difference is that there is explicit quantification in the linguistic expression, and that you can check whether it applies or not. That's what it's happening in this case. I'm not sure what was the point of that.
That's
a good question. So, but what I think about the symbolic depictions that they don't include quantification. Even if it's everyone is standing, it doesn't include quantification. I have a colleague of mine actually trying to study this with infants to see whether when show this kind of infants, whether they try to extract quantification without any language from this. He has not yet succeeded, but we'll see. We'll see whether he succeeds or not. But definitely, explicitly, is not there.
But so the judgment that the caption correctly describes the picture, that indicates there must be the ability to connect the two and evaluate the caption on the basis of what the observer has got from looking at the picture. And if what he's got from looking at the picture is a symbolic depiction, is what he does when concluding that the caption is correct, something like evaluating that bit of language with respect or on the symbolic depiction he has formed, a bit in the sense in which, semanticists want to analyze quantificational statements as true or false in particular models. Would you say or conjecture that the symbolic depiction serves in this judgment as something like a model in which the caption is evaluated? Is that the kind of relation between the two that must be verified by the observer if he concludes that the caption is correct?
I'm not sure I understand the question. What's the alternative?
Well, what I'm trying to say is the system of symbolic depictions has this, this limited expressive power that you mentioned.
Yes.
And so they are sort of, you would, in logical terms, they are collections of basic predications. There is no connection in the form of logical operators between those predications. And that is something, of course, clearly simpler than what you can do with language, and in particular when you use certain logical operators that language makes available, like in this particular case, these quantifiers.
Yes.
So the question is exactly what is involved in the mental operations that the observer must execute to determine that the caption is a correct description of this symbolic depiction.
Well, I don't know. They have to have some kind of translations between these systems, if that's what that's what you are.
Well, it can't be just translation, because the caption is an instance of an expressive power that the language has and that the system of symbolic depiction doesn't have.
Right.
So intuitively, you would say, well, because I've been saying this all along, the caption is true of the depiction. And I was asking whether you have particular views of what, say, the cognitive explanation or definition would be of this notion is true of, where the caption is true of the depiction.
I don't, but I'm guessing what's going on here is that you have a language of thought which allows you to represent whatever the caption states.
Yeah.
And then you translate it into some kind of language of thought, which includes quantification. And then you are trying to match these two. I don't know how, actually. I don't know how. You try to match these two kinds of representations. And then you realize that the symbolic depictions actually has an implicit quantification, right? In that sense that applies to that all of them are standing, right? I don't know how you do that. Or it's possible that you already represented them in some way. It's just not expressed in the depiction because there is no specific symbols for quantification. It's a very good question, but I'm very far away from there to get to that point that when I can investigate this.
It's really a question in the context of what you've been saying about the compositionality of language.
Thank you. I have a question, or I was curious of how you would interpret the variation of the Loach task where she places the scale model behind a transparent barrier. Nothing else changes, and two-year-old then succeed while they previously failed. So I'm not sure in your account. It goes a bit back to the question of what changes if the object used as a symbol has different material affordances, properties, and.
So those are 2.5 year olds, and that's again not it's a pointing study. So behind the display, they point that the object is hidden here. They don't hide the objects. They don't have to figure out the relations between those symbolic objects, spatial relations, in order to find it. But it's pointed to them, so it's a demonstrative. That's far as I remember. Am I right? Yes.
But I think then she does the same with photographs of pieces of furniture as potential hiding location, and she's also pointing, and they fail at the same age. So at 2 years old, they don't succeed when it's still pointing, not hiding, but it's only photographs of the specific pieces of furniture.
I don't know. To be honest, I had the impression that the other way around, that it's easier with photographs and pictures than with objects, but I may not have the full picture here. Yeah.
Any last question? Or Nick had your question before, so.
Hi, thanks. I have a quite naive question. So you said, if I'm correct, that symbolic depictions have a clear argument predicate structure. So you have, let's say, a stuffed toy inside of a bin, right? And it's clear that the toy stands for some other toy, and the bin stands for some other bin. But insofar as this depicts the toy being inside the bin, what part of this scene clearly stands for the relation of X is inside of Y?
The actual spatial relations in the model between the two toys. That's the...
Can
you pass the mic?
Right, sorry. Yeah. Because I'm thinking maybe here by predicate argument structure, one could mean there was a symbol for the predicate and there was a symbol for the argument, and somehow some spatial relation between the two means that the predicate is predicated of the argument. And here, that doesn't seem to be the case, right? There isn't any predicate or relational symbol per se that relation like in which would have two arguments, the thing inside and the thing right. containing the thing inside. That doesn't seem to be the case. Maybe this is what worry meant.
Okay, good. That's it. That's all I meant. If it conveys any meaning, the predicates are represented by these spatio-temporal relations. And that what I meant by clear predicate argument structure is that they are really different elements of the scene that represents predicates and arguments. That's all I meant.
I'll just report an intuition, which is that you can point to the stuffed animal, the symbol. You can point for the another stuffed animal. You can point to the bin, which is a symbol for another thing, but it seems much harder to point to the spatial relation, which is the symbol that depicts this other thing. And I think that's the intuition I'm trying to get at.
I agree, but you don't have to point, because that spatial relation is there. So you just have to interpret them. You just see them as being there in order to express or represent something, and then you interpret them. It doesn't require pointing at all.
Nick.
So this is a very general kind of high-level way of dividing up accounts, which applies to your discussion and also in the first talk. So clearly we do simulation of, I mean, you've made a very strong case that we do simulations of the kind that you spoke about. Like, for example, we use visual imagery, and then we have some discourse reference that give us a way of understanding what we're doing with our visual imagery. I might be imagining how to arrange the speakers at a conference at lunch or something. I think we've got some evidence that there are other kinds of simulation, like the stuff that's studied in mice and rats, when they can do offline route planning that seems to just run a kind of simulation in the medial temporal lobe involving the place cells and hippocampus, and that simulation is the basis of an inference by which they then choose a route, but probably not a second set of discourse reference involved there. That's just those bits of the hippocampus are playing a standing in for the world relation, which allows the rat to choose the left or right, but without us having to posit a second level of representation. So let me just get to the question. So I would hypothesize that all of your cases here involve decoupling, in the way that the rat and mice case has to have some decoupling of the system from its online mode of operation in order to do the simulation. And then in addition, some of them also require a second level of representation of the kind that we have when I'm, you know, planning the arrangement of people at dinner, but that not all of these involve the second level of representation as well as the decoupling.
So there are no discourse reference in the rat case. They use the same system, right? But it's not as discourse reference. This is just how you borrow your representation, long-term representations. You put them into the system and you manipulate them in order to plan or imagine something, right? So if you say that is decoupling, you can say it is decoupling. But what it is decoupling from? It's just it's decoupling for present perception or whatever. That's what you mean. That yes, but it doesn't require any additional operations. The decoupling is just the simulation itself. So what is the second layer of the addition? Is that what you mean by using as discourse reference?
So, for example, watching the Heider and Simmel animation, my sense is when I'm first watching it, I just have some kind of minimal decoupling. So my object tracking system is working. It's firing a kind of agentive thing. I've got some decoupling in that I don't think these are normal 3D objects, but it's just that there's not a second level of representation. There's just the system's running in a slightly decoupled mode. And then when I think about it a bit more, I think, now this one is the agent. It wants to get this one. This one is small and frightened. Then I've introduced discourse reference, and there's a second thing going on. So maybe in your 1995 animations with the infants, they're running the object tracking plus goal system in slightly decoupled mode, but they don't need a second level of representation. Other of them, clearly you do need a second level of representation, you need discourse reference.
I'm not sure, so I'm not sure at all whether there is this. I mean, you can always get leaner or richer interpretation of what's going on, but that there is a levels, I'm absolutely not sure. So at least, as soon as you interpret them as depictions, right, then the discourse reference is there. How much you put into this discourse referent from your inferences, from your background knowledge, or pragmatic context—that's a question. But I'm not sure whether this is different. It makes a different kind of representation. It's just the cargo, as Gabo would say.
Follow up very quickly.
I just wanted to ask, because I think by now I'm completely confused whether there's a substantive difference between decoupling and the type of... So I understand this as a type of decoupling, like a form of cashing out what decoupling is, that you have two levels of representation. I feel like the running in decoupling mode is sort of the same thing without saying how exactly the decoupling happens, and I can imagine it in this way or in other ways, but I just wanted to ask whether is that a fair way of understanding that this is an implementation of decoupling, or...
It's not decoupling, it's replacing what was thought to be decoupling. It's just creating an additional representation and linking them in a specific way. It doesn't have to decouple because it is never thought that this banana is a telephone, right? So you don't have to inhibit that and decouple that. It is. There is an additional representation, which is the telephone, and the link. There is a particular link that explains them how to track this relation. But there is no need for decoupling.
Valeria has a final, very, very quick question.
Yes, because it goes back to this idea of action demonstration versus instructions. So in the case of the group, the online behaviors that you can find in animals, you might have this kind of action demonstrations or not for you. I mean, in that case, you would just have to be a kind of instinct behavior, online behavior or something like that without an action demonstration.
The question is whether there is an action demonstration
in animals. Because you can find the cases where they, like the one that was mentioned.
I don't think that is the action demonstration in that sense that I use it. It's definitely true that there are species where, in birds, for example, they call the youngs to follow them. And then where to find food, right? But the point is not representing how to find food, but to find food, right? That's a difference.
If
that's the case, yes, of course, communication exists. But it's not a representational system, not an open representational system that you can use. Completely arbitrary symbols to place in place of anything else. In that sense, it's much simpler. Otherwise, it's actually much more complex. That things that this representation would not be able to do. For example, to represent distance and directions of entities. There's no way that this represented that without additional language.
Thank you very much.
Collège de France. Le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.